and women, including gonorrhea and chlamydia. And although it has been shown to inactivate HIV in test tubes, N9 has not been shown to prevent HIV infection in actual use in humans. In addition, important questions remain regarding the effectiveness and safety of both individual application dosages and continued use of products containing N9. CDC will continue research to answer these questions, as well as to develop and evaluate new products that might protect women against infection and do not require the knowledge or consent of a woman's partner. While heterosexual transmission has overshadowed injection drug use as the number one risk factor for women in this country, substance abuse does continue to play a significant role. We already heard that it contributes substantially to heterosexual transmission as well. Recall, even he is having problems. Thank you. Recall that about a third of women reported with AIDS in 1996 were infected through injection drug use. Their primary risk factor here was sharing of needles. And despite political obstacles, many local strategies, including needle exchange programs, deregulation, and decriminalization, have been effective in reducing needle sharing. But injection drug use is not the only way that substance abuse is fueling the HIV epidemic. Are we caught up yet? Data from a CDC study of young adults ages 18 to 29 shows clearly that crack use is associated with heterosexual transmission of HIV. The study, which involved street-recruited youth in New York, Miami, and San Francisco, showed that 15.7% of those who smoked crack regularly were HIV infected, compared to only 5.2% of those who had never smoked crack. Moreover, the study showed that women who had recently had unprotected sex in exchange for drugs or for money or other commodities were as likely to be infected as men who had sex with men. HIV prevention among injection drug users is a complicated issue. But there are some basic principles in which CDC believes very strongly. First, we believe that all HIV prevention programs targeting drug users should be closely linked to drug treatment and prevention programs. In addition, we believe that decisions about prevention strategies should be made at the local level and must address the unique HIV prevention needs of each community and the people who live there. For this reason, CDC strongly supports community-designed, community-implemented, and community-evaluated strategies to combat HIV and AIDS among injection drug users and their partners. CDC also believes that programs must incorporate strategies to address HIV prevention among users who continue to inject or use drugs. Substance abuse treatment programs will continue to play a vital role in combating the HIV epidemic in this country. Today, there are an estimated 1.5 million active drug users in the United States. However, nationwide, less than 500,000 drug treatment slots are available at any given time. And there's an enormous need for treatment programs that are more accessible, sensitive, and responsive to the needs of women, particularly women with children. Clearly, the need for drug treatment for women in this country outstrips the current capacity to provide it. For women who are or want to become mothers, an extremely important issue is the health of their children. In this regard, women with HIV differ little from women who are not infected. Between 1988 and 1993, approximately 6,000 to 7,000 children were born each year to HIV-infected women. And during this time, an estimated 1,000 to 2,000 of their newborns also became infected annually. But as all of you know, after the results were released of ACTG-076 showing that AZT administration during pregnancy and delivery and then to the baby afterwards could reduce the risk of transmission by as much as two-thirds, the U.S. Public Health Service issued guidelines. Those were rapidly implemented, the basis of those guidelines that routine HIV counseling and voluntary testing for all pregnant women in the United States should be the standard of care. I'm going to flip through these to catch up. Almost immediately, we began to see a decrease in perinatally acquired AIDS. In 1995, the estimated annual number of children, I'll get to that. In 1995, the estimated annual number of children with perinatally acquired AIDS decreased to 663, a 27% decline when compared to 1992. Our position was then and is now that routine counseling and voluntary testing should be standard of care for all pregnant women. I can't say it enough. Clearly, we know it now works. We now know it works. We've heard this at this meeting. And despite proposals to mandate testing for pregnant women, we believe from a public health perspective that voluntary testing is more effective. As we learn more about new treatment options, a woman's decisions will become even more complex. A trusting relationship between a woman and her healthcare provider will be crucial to the woman's decision-making. Sadly, the developing world has not yet reaped the benefits of earlier perinatal research. A number of studies are underway overseas to examine the effectiveness of short-course oral AZT therapy late in pregnancy. These studies are supported by the World Health Organization, the UN Joint Program on AIDS, and other leading public health institutions worldwide, in addition to CDC and NIH. Because in most developing countries, no interventions are available to prevent perinatal HIV transmission, and women often do not present for care until they are ready for delivery, these studies are essential to provide rapid and scientifically valid assessment of alternative drug regimens that can be sustained and paid for within those countries. We're also working with NIH and the FDA to review whether or not to recommend triple drug therapy during pregnancy. Although this treatment's not currently approved for use during pregnancy, we believe it absolutely must be considered and reviewed carefully to see if it may be a potentially effective, safe, and viable option for women who are pregnant and their babies. Women desperately need this information. All of us understand that the best way to prevent perinatal transmission is to prevent HIV in women. If we have learned anything from the AIDS epidemic, it is that the best way to prevent perinatal transmission is to prevent HIV infection in women.
Thank you.
Thank you. If we have learned anything from this epidemic, it is that in order to be effective, HIV prevention programs must meet the specific needs of their target populations. Our best hope for effective targeting is for communities to plan their own responses to the epidemic, and thus CDC supports a program called HIV Prevention Community Planning. We will continue to evaluate community planning to ensure that HIV prevention programs meet the specific needs of women. A 1995 survey of the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors found that 54% of community planning group members were women. In addition, almost half the community planning group co-chairs nationwide are women. And recent evaluation activities indicate that prevention programs are becoming more targeted to... He's back there. Thank you. And accepted by women. Applications for 1997 federal prevention funds show that virtually all jurisdictions target women in the innumerable prevention efforts aimed at populations. I feel like I should be slowing down like the TV does when it fades out or something. Virtually all jurisdictions target women in the innumerable prevention efforts aimed at populations at risk that include both genders. For example, youth, the homeless, and incarcerated populations. In addition, an in-depth review of 54 applications showed that 88% of jurisdictions were planning to fund prevention efforts specifically targeting women. We know much remains to be done. We're getting there, but we still have work to do. Today, the horizon of HIV prevention is changing. Some would say the sun is setting on the epidemic, that the AIDS crisis is over. But we say to them this is not true. Rather, a new day is dawning, one that presents not only tremendous challenges for HIV prevention, but tremendous and immense opportunities as well. Every day in the world, over 3,000 women are diagnosed with AIDS. AIDS continues to increase worldwide despite advances in research and treatment that just a few years ago we couldn't have dreamed of. Clearly, we cannot afford to forget prevention. Over the past few years, we've seen this progress in treatment and in care. But we know from experience that it is possible to change behaviors that place individuals at risk of infection. And many of the presentations you have heard at this meeting this week show that women can and do take steps to protect themselves. There is reason for hope, although the road ahead will not be easy. The challenges that lie ahead are undoubtedly some of the most difficult we have seen in the history of the epidemic. But from a policy perspective, it is essential that we find ways to work together to move toward a policy around women and AIDS that is progressive, a policy that strengthens prevention efforts targeting adolescents and young women, women of color, and other women at increased risk of infection, a policy that integrates what we've learned about the link between STDs and HIV transmission, a policy that reflects a more enlightened approach to needle exchange, drug treatment, and other interventions to prevent drug-related transmission in women, a policy that ensures that pregnant women who are not in prenatal care do not fall through the cracks in the system, and a policy that ensures that all women benefit from the latest advances in prevention, treatment, and research. Thank you. I am honored by your presence here today.
We're going to wait till the end and make sure everybody gets to their talk. Okay, we'd like to move right along. I've noticed a number of women fanning yourselves. I know it got really hot in here and very stuffy, but I think the air went on. Is everyone getting a little more comfortable? Because we can ask them to fill it with the air if not. Now we're going to get the cold ones and the hot ones fighting. Okay, thank you. I'd like to introduce Carola Marta, who is a physician with the Yale AIDS Program and whose work is focused on inner-city primary care and women's health. Much of her work and writing has been on medical and social issues concerning women with AIDS and chemically dependent women, and she's worked with local, national, and international groups of care providers and HIV-positive women to establish and advocate for services and public health policies of importance to women and families who are infected and affected by the HIV epidemic. Carola.
I'm
Carola's going to speak from the table, so if you have a hard time hearing because you can't see as well, please let us know.
Well, I think I can use the mic, but I can't quite see everyone, so please bear with me.
Can people in the back hear from here?
Can you hear me? The mic should, I think the mic's working. Yeah, okay. Okay, first I just want to say that I really have appreciated the speakers that preceded me, and it means that I can cross out, among other things, a couple of pages of talk that were said much better as they were. And I'm starting with a little bit of a quandary that I think is probably analogous to what Maxine said at the beginning of her talk. That's, we're all aware of the many ways in which services for HIV-positive women are lacking or inadequate. I found it really hard to know where to begin this seemingly straightforward topic about policy and clinical services because I think in the United States there is no health policy. We don't have systematic ways to make policy, we don't have ways to enforce policy, and the policies that we do have are piecemeal and usually arise from lobbying efforts by special interest groups, sometimes at the last minute, usually at the last minute out of right field where it concerns women with AIDS. And I'm thinking, for instance, of the Coburn Amendment to the Ryan White on mandatory neonatal and prenatal testing that just came out of nowhere. There was no way we could organize the time. Okay, fine. So the bottom line, and where I should start, is that the only way to solve these problems, really, is that we need a single-payer health system and a national health plan. That's the only health care policy that has even a chance of guaranteeing that everyone, including women, including the poor, can have access and receive all the services they need. Having said that, I'm going to move on to some specific topics, and I'm going to start with service delivery models because I think that also speaks to the issue of access. The remarkable fact about the HIV epidemic is that it has forced the issue of accessible and usable services that really do work for the many people, mostly poor, that historically have had none and who take a dim view about medical providers and institutions. In this audience, we probably agree that the comprehensive model of care, sometimes called one-stop shopping, should be the goal for all healthcare facilities that treat HIV-positive women. That means minimally combining all basic medical and support services. To find financing, and I'm sure there are many people here who know this from experience, to find financing, space, and staff to develop a full-service model is very difficult in our current healthcare system. But I'm going to use the Cook County Women and Children's Program in Chicago, with which probably many here are familiar, to define an example of a system that really does work. And just briefly to go through the essential points. First, it's a primary care model. It offers a full range of clinical care needed by women with or without children in a single location. Pediatrics, gynecology, infectious diseases, mental health don't require separate visits to different clinics. Second, it is a service-driven model. Services are organized and staffed in response to what patients need rather than for the convenience of providers. Third, it is woman-centered, a feminist perspective on the realities of the women's lives who attend that particular clinic informs its organization and staff attitudes. In this clinic, issues such as domestic violence, substance abuse, loss of children to foster care, are not only acknowledged but addressed with concrete and supportive programs. In a traditional clinic, clinicians are not expected to ask about these issues, and most don't. However, because of large numbers of people who are HIV positive and can't or won't use traditional hospital clinics, states, for instance New York, have put in place a policy to promote HIV primary care in non-traditional settings, such as drug treatment facilities and family planning clinics for the, quote, hard-to-reach populations. In fact, many women have benefited from this policy. The Beth Israel Methadone Program in New York City serves several thousand individuals, about one-third of whom are HIV positive on admission, and 35% are women. With state funding, we set up on-site HIV primary care, ultimately in three central locations that were accessible to nearly everyone in the programs. We knew that the majority of our HIV-positive clients were not seeking or getting care, despite multiple referrals to Beth Israel Hospital or other closer infectious disease clinics. The largest proportion of these, in fact, were asymptomatic women. Two-thirds of those whose status we knew about were not in care, and that compares to one-third of the asymptomatic men. But patients who used these HIV clinics when they were set up, 40% were women. Focus groups had identified the fear of being treated with stigma and contempt, and the long waits for appointments and at appointments as the two major disincentives for this group of people to seeking care. The focus groups also confirmed that patients trusted the methadone program staff, knew that they should be getting care, and thought on-site care was a good idea, and those conclusions were not ones that we had predicted. Confidentiality was not an issue with respect to staff. It was with respect to other patients, and that was a difficult problem that we could never fully solve with on-site services in the drug treatment facilities. I won't pretend that recruiting clinicians to this setting was easy, but staff positions were filled without difficulty, again unpredicted, by longtime methadone staffers who chose to transfer to the HIV clinic because of their commitment to patients. This small cadre of devoted staff, unfortunately, was not typical. Resistance was. Convincing the program's administration that on-site services were imperative took as much time and effort as setting up the services did, and resistance ran from the top to the bottom of the program, making it difficult to enforce standards and hold clinic staff accountable. And that really wasn't just a Beth Israel problem. That's been pretty much of the experience with drug treatment programs across the board in trying to set up medical services. Funding and pressure in this case from state health department administrators and active support from the higher hospital administration, which is over the methadone program, from the CEO in particular, were crucial to the success of the clinic. Another model, Community Family Planning Council, CFPC, is also a network of clinics in severely underserved New York City neighborhoods. Right? From the beginning, it combined family planning, prenatal, and sexually transmitted disease services for women. This setting is ideal for comprehensive HIV care for women because it is woman-centered. We know that most women use their gynecologist as their main or only provider, and it's a model that already integrated family planning and STD services. Several sessions at this conference have addressed the importance of doing that for a variety of reasons. CFPC set up counseling and testing, case management, and then comprehensive HIV primary care, first for women, then for other family members. As with methadone clinics, state funding paid for startup of services that subsequently are meant to be supported by reimbursements from Medicaid and other sources. That's half pie in the sky. I recently learned that CFPC's adult HIV primary care caseload is now unexpectedly about 50% men. Why should this be in a family planning, woman-centered setting? Presumably because neighborhood-based facilities within the communities that they serve can do what most institutional settings cannot, which is to be fully accessible geographically as well as, and this is at least as important, culturally and socially. A third model is the mobile van. It does not serve large numbers, but it can target individuals who use no health services, homeless youths and adults, street prostitutes, active drug users. CFPC now operates actually two mobile vans to increase the number of people that they can reach. A NIDA-funded community health care van in New Haven, a new one, follows the same street route as our needle exchange program, which is well established, and the health care services are doing very well. It may be useful to also describe some of the systemic problems that I and others have encountered in developing such services. Briefly enumerated, the services are designed to care for persons with early disease, but referring sicker patients to hospital clinics rarely works. Neither providers nor patients want to break the bond, and you're left with the original problem that the patients who are in the drug treatment facilities or family planning never wanted to go to those settings to begin with. It's difficult to find pediatricians willing to work in isolation from a pediatrics department, which most of these sites don't have. And specialty services overall are a real problem because few consultants will come into poor neighborhoods and hospitals do not wish to provide backup for indigent patients. We didn't officially get a hospital backup for the Harlem facility for 2.5 years after the clinic had opened. The toughest problem is setting up drug treatment services in medical clinics and vice versa, medical services in drug treatment programs, or actually mental health services anywhere outside of mental health clinics. Multidisciplinary models, cross-administrative divisions, and combined services that are ordinarily separately funded, separately licensed, and separately regulated by departments of health, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, mental health, social services, it's different in every state. I think the most important point is that none of the problems is insurmountable, as the models I've described proves. But it does not make sense for each clinic to have to fight the same battles. They're frustrating, they're costly, they're time-consuming. State policy needs to be formulated that facilitates funding and licensing across whatever administrative divisions exist in that state's organizational structure so that these models can finally be mainstream. These are not new models anymore that I'm talking about. We need to work with our legislators and state agencies. Managed care capitation is upon us. It may at least provide some opportunity to work for standards of care and adequate reimbursements for HIV care, and that certainly are the key issues we need to fight over in each state as they shift to managed care. At this juncture, it is very important in each state to follow the legislative process closely and locate those legislators and staff who are advocates and potential allies. I'm going to just digress slightly for a minute to make another comment on services. In this era of very complex antiretroviral regimens and studies showing that the patients of more experienced providers have better outcomes, the argument is being made that HIV care should be turned back over to infectious disease experts. There are a lot of excellent infectious disease clinics, and many are moving towards some form of comprehensive services. And non-hospital-based clinics certainly could not survive without their expertise in educational clinic. But the non-hospital-based services that I'm describing serve many patients that the ID clinics can't. We need both. No clinic serving an HIV-positive patient should have to be without an infectious disease present, and many are. In fact, that's the rule rather than the exception. The infectious disease profession could and should adopt a policy to commit a certain amount of time to on-site consulting in community facilities. Prisons and jails. Prison policy on HIV services is an important issue for women and far too often neglected. Many HIV-positive women are in prison or jail at some time in their lives, sometimes cycling in and out, and many women receive their HIV diagnosis while incarcerated. Over one-third of all prison deaths are now AIDS-related in this country. In Connecticut, in 1996, 6% of men and 17% of women were HIV positive. HIV seroprevalence rates nationally are higher for women than for men, presumably because women are convicted of relatively more drug and prostitution charges but fewer violent crimes than men are. There should be far fewer women in prison, and there could be. Most of these women are young and many have children. For most, prison or jail is not the right place for the crimes that they've been convicted of. There needs to be alternative sentencing to prison to drug treatment instead for drug-related offenses, and prostitution needs to be decriminalized. Very few prisons and jails offer HIV care. Medical care and access to medications is interrupted when a woman enters a prison or jail. It's a kind of forced non-compliance. Some women may refuse care that is available for fear of stigma and violence. One of my patients would simply not take her AZT in prison because the capsules are so easily identified and she didn't want to be labeled in that particular prison as HIV positive. For severely ill women, there needs to be a policy of compassionate release or medical parole so that they can spend their last days with their family, not locked up. In New York and Connecticut's women's prisons, good health services actually do exist. But this is for one reason only. This is because of class action suits that were brought on behalf of the women prisoners and because of continuing state oversight, of court oversight. Such a suit is now being fought here in California by the ACLU's National Prison Project together with Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, a San Francisco agency. 9,800 women were in prisons in California last year, more than in any other state or in the federal system. The California suit needs to be supported strongly here and emulated in other states. I'm going to make just one comment on research, and that's about the interface between research and clinical trials and services.
And it's just really to state that there are many examples of successful accrual of women in clinical trials, including several of the ACTG and CPCRA sites. Significantly, the best accrual rates tend to be at sites where there are female principal investigators, and that's been shown in several different sites and studies in series. My own experience enrolling women from the Beth Israel Methadone Program in New York City, first in the New York Cervical Disease Study, and then as we started up the WISE at the time that I was still at Beth Israel, that it's, I think in my experience, has been what everyone's is, that research and clinical recruitment and retention do not present different problems. The same factors that block access to care for clinical trials, whether it's transportation, child care, compensation, whatever, is the same thing as in research. And the problem with women, I think, has been that the clinical services haven't been there. So there's been no infrastructure that you could build on. And what we found at Beth Israel is, for instance, in women's health, if you built the infrastructure, the research, recruitment, and retention took care of itself. So that's really, I think, what's important for research. There's one more comment I want to make, actually, also listening to some of these slides. I think a major issue, and it goes well beyond clinical care issues, is the definitions that we use, the demographic, the risk, the other definitions. And I think that actually they have a major impact on women understanding that they're at risk, that women understanding how to take care of themselves, and at least as much for the providers also, especially those who are not really specialized in women and HIV, which few are. First, there's the CDC definition of risk, and I think we really need to change. It's time to change it, whatever that does to skew statistics. And it needs to be changed specifically in the following way. It should not be hierarchical that any woman who has ever been an intravenous drug user, the sexual risk of exposure is completely ignored and she's put into the IDU category. We need a category that says both IDU and sexual exposure, that needs to be a combination. I think what's happening, it's really obscuring both multiple risks, and it's especially obscuring sexual risk. I ran across recently the abstract of a study, I don't even know if it's been published, but it was a NIDA study in northern Manhattan and Washington Heights that Sherry Darren did. And she actually, just in her own work, or in this particular study, someone made the decision to actually not follow the CDC hierarchical classification. In that study, which was on women in a heavily drug-using community, the statistics came out this way. Heterosexual only, as far as they were aware, 43%. IDU only, 2%. IDU plus heterosexual, 55%. So that's way off than it would have been if the hierarchical classification system had been used. And I think that's something that everyone can start doing in describing whatever their own work or their own groups they work with is, as well as advocating with CDC to see if we can't get a transition. And the other comment I just want to make on definitions is we've moved from individuals at risk to behaviors of risk. I still think that really obscures the fact that this is a social disease about communities and it's not about individuals, because behavior is a kind of disembodied abstraction that's also about individual behavior. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't start talking about neighborhoods at risk, because as any epidemiologist knows, epidemic spread within communities and neighborhood by neighborhood and really reflect the conditions of those communities. And I hope many of you heard Sally Zierler's talk yesterday, in which she really developed that beautifully. And Belinda Dunn, actually, also, I was thinking of Sally's slides, but the whole talk was really based on that premise. In conclusion, I would like to say that the importance of policy in the programming of this particular conference is really striking, and it's a tribute to the conference leadership. I do not recall the same focus on policy at the two previous Women in HIV conferences. We habitually think of government officials as the experts on policy.
The truth is that people who are HIV positive and who live in HIV-infected communities are the best informed and the most discerning about the effects of good or bad policy. Women's voices need to be heard in the chambers where policy is formulated. We need to speak from our own experience, and we need to speak for ourselves.
Thank you, Carola. We have one more presentation. I appreciate you all sitting diligently through the four talks, and we hopefully will preserve some time at the end for some questions if everyone's willing to stick around for a few extra minutes. There's nothing officially scheduled except a press conference immediately after this, so most of us can probably stay around. I'd next like to introduce Michelle Lopez, who is a community activist involved in issues of concern to women and children, and particularly in New York. And she's also a member of the planning group for this entire conference. Michelle.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Michelle Lopez, and I'm a woman living with AIDS. I'm also a member of the planning board of the National Conference on Women and HIV. It's with that perspective that I come to address this session, defining a national AIDS policy from a community perspective. Okay, let me take a breath, because I'm going to ask some hard questions, and I want to get my power up. You know about power. It's what the scientists and the doctors and even some of our friends think we don't have. Well, that's what I want to talk about, taking our power back. And if you're new to this AIDS thing, it's called powering up. So let's look at defining a national AIDS policy. The first thing that I would like to ask, why don't we already have one? Who can remember that big meeting in Washington in December of 1995, where the President of the United States and our friend Donna Shalala, then AIDS Czar Patsy Fleming, and a whole lot of scientists and service providers, and I think there were some people with AIDS. Wait. ACT UP and Housing Works were left out in the cold, weren't they? Anyway, you don't know this, some of you do, but they invited me to the White House, but I was in the hospital, and besides, to me, there was too much tokenism going on up there anyway. So that day, when the meeting happened, I had just gotten out of the hospital after 2 weeks on triple antibiotics and a biopsy for pre-cervical cancer, and I decided to get on the ACT UP bus and head on up to Washington. It was a cold day, because I know I was outside with my friends, trying to be warm, yelling for my life with my friends. But that day, there were lots of women telling the president and telling Shalala and telling Patsy Fleming that women have to be included in any research and protocols in AIDS. Everyone nodded. Yeah, that's right. Can't let the women die. And President Clinton said he wanted to create a national goal, and this is his quote, to reduce the number of new infections each and every year until there are no more new infections. He said he wanted scientists to find a vaccine and find a cure. And he said that he heard our issues about lack of access to treatment and care. But what did they wind up doing for women? They wound up caring more about babies than the mother or lesbians, or women without children. And I'm very sensitive. I'm very sensitive about this issue because my 6-year-old daughter is infected. But how the hell am I supposed to take care of my child when there is very little help for me? So policy-wise, wouldn't it be more cost-effective for the government to find out what's happening with my body so I can take care of me and my child? Instead of having my child cast into these systems that are failing children more and more, I don't even want to think what could possibly happen to my child in a foster care situation. But back to the president. Bill Clinton made the American people, he made them think that there was a national AIDS policy. Not to worry, Big Daddy Bill was on the case, and he was going to make sure that all the government agencies worked as hard as they could end this epidemic. And pretty soon after that, protease inhibitors started working wonders on gay men. So people started thinking that AIDS was over. And one more time, women were left out in the cold. Well, it's been pretty hot. It's been pretty hot here in Pasadena. But you know what? Sometimes during this conference, I felt cold. As I said in the beginning, I was on the conference planning board. But to tell you the truth, I had no idea how far behind we were until I really got here. And while I'm very happy for my gay brothers that are not dying as fast as they used to, and that they can have access to treatment and care, I am pissed as hell that we women are worse off. Our rates are up, and we are dying faster. And to tell you the truth, I am so sad because I know this might be me also. So just like I yelled at the White House to keep me warm, I'm going to let my anger keep me, Michelle Lopez, fired up. And I'm going to take back my power by making demands and pressing for the truth. So with this in mind, let's look at this conference. First of all,